This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February the 3rd, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the Egyptian government continues its crackdown on activists, beating, arresting, and detaining dozens of journalists, human rights activists, and lawyers. Hundreds of academics call for a radical change to US Middle East foreign policy. And a county in Alabama challenges the decades-old Voting Rights Act. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with News Briefs for Free Speech Radio News. Accusations are flying in Zimbabwe today, with supporters of President Robert Mugabe accusing Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai of inciting anti-government uprisings. Tsvangirai supporters, in turn, say they have been subject to attacks from Mugabe backers that have left several people in the hospital. Clashes broke out in the capital on Monday and peaked yesterday when protesters moved in on the Harare City Council headquarters. Conditions are calmer today. Widely anticipated riots failed to materialize in Haiti today after the country's electoral council decided which two presidential candidates will compete in a March 20th runoff. FSRN's Ansel Herz has the update.
Right-leaning candidates Miriam Nightingale and Michel Martelly received the most votes in November's flawed election, according to the council. This morning's announcement was a reversal of initial results, which had Nightingale facing Jude Celestin, the government-backed candidate. There were intense protests by Martelly supporters, then a report from the Organization of American States recommending Celestin be dropped from the race. In the election, only about 20% of Haiti's registered voters went to the polls. At least 12 of the 19 presidential candidates called for the election to be annulled and restarted. Observers say the new government is likely to struggle for popular legitimacy. Ansel Herz, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
Pakistani authorities continue to hold a U.S. contractor accused of murdering two Pakistani men. The American, Raymond Davis, says he shot the men in self-defense during an attempted carjacking. A Pakistani court ruled today to extend Davis's detention by 8 days while the investigation continues. The U.S. says Davis is a diplomat, but the court in Lahore is challenging that, trying to keep jurisdiction over the case. After last year's internationally criticized elections failed to bring democratic change to the military-controlled government of Myanmar, the country's parliament has nominated three candidates to hold the presidency, all of whom are loyal to the junta. No matter who is chosen to take the top role, analysts say no real change will likely occur. It's believed that the current leader, General Thanh Shwe, will continue to rule from behind the scenes. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke addressed the U.S. economic situation today, giving a sober outlook for job growth.
With output growth likely to be moderate for a while, and with employers reportedly still reluctant to add to their payrolls, it will be several years before the unemployment rate has returned to a more normal level. Until we see a sustained period of stronger job creation, we cannot consider the recovery to be truly established.
He says he expects economic growth to continue, but traditional Fed methods of stimulating the economy, namely lowering interest rates, are not currently available because interest rates are already historically low. Bernanke says it is instead looking at other methods, including a plan to purchase securities later this year. And finally, Senate Republicans failed to push through a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The repeal effort failed in a 51-47 vote along party lines. This means Republican efforts to usher in a complete health care repeal are defeated, but smaller measures designed to chip away at the CARE Act will likely make their way to vote in the coming months. And that's News Briefs for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Fears are growing in Egypt after a second day of violent attacks on opposition demonstrators and journalists. In the capital, at least 12 have been killed and more than 1,000 injured over the last 24 hours. Cairo's Tahrir Square and surrounding streets have become a revolutionary stronghold where opposition activists defend themselves behind makeshift barricades from groups of men wielding fists, knives, sticks, and Molotov cocktails. In one incident captured on video, a police van speeds into a crowd of people peacefully assembling, running over several of them.
No, no,
The bystanders rush to aid the injured, while the man shooting the video and those around him start chanting. In what appears to be an organized crackdown, a growing number of journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, and professors have been arrested or are reported missing. One of those temporarily detained today was Egyptian activist and blogger Sand Monkey, who was ambushed in his car and beaten by police. In an interview yesterday, he told Roger Simon with Pajamas Media that demonstrators have been committed to non-violence.
In any of those demonstrations, or even in Tahrir, there wasn't one case of harassment when someone tried to even like grab a piece of rock or like a weapon with them in the protest. The people would like take the weapons away from them and remind them this is a peaceful protest. From the beginning, we were unarmed and unwilling to fight anybody. You know, we were just gonna make an example, you know, of all the people who are like using the violence against us.
Attacks continued throughout the day, despite a pledge from Egypt's new Prime Minister, Ahmed Shafik, to investigate and punish those involved. Even with the threat of violence, many opposition activists vow to continue demonstrating until President Mubarak resigns. Blogger Wael Khalil has been in the streets for over a week. He spoke to FSRN's Lillian Boktor about what opposition activists have planned next.
So the military is asking for the protesters to go home. What is your reaction to this?
We haven't heard of that demand. That statement is a media statement so far. I mean, they haven't used megaphones or microphones to tell us anything like that. So I don't think people are seeing the military as a threat as such. Quite the opposite. Today, at one of the gates, the military did help send some of the attackers by shooting in the air. So I think the military post and personnel are acting on their own. So we have one who's really disappeared, another entrance was really who fended off the attackers, and currently we hear from outside that the military is preventing more attackers from getting to the square.
So what are your plans, Wael? What are your plans over the next few days and the plans of the other people in Midan Tahrir?
Our plans are made up by the event, and it's clear that since the 25th of January, it's clear to us that we are here until Mubarak falls. And this is something that we didn't plan prior to the protest. We were protesting against the regime, but in the way the regime attacked us on the 25th, on the midnight, on the 26th, when we were in the square celebrating, enjoying our time, and they attacked us with rubber bullets and with tear gas. And then we've been taken to the street, but on Friday, everyone was marching to the square. The square meant liberation. Tahrir means liberation. And without really people using the word and its meaning, it happened to be that. Everyone believed that if we stood our ground, if we have more people on the ground, we get our demand. So the plan that we defend Tahrir, and on Friday, will mobilize something that's never seen before in Egypt. And I believe on yesterday we had something that again was never seen in Egypt, but on Friday we have even more, because people who were starting to believe the president's promises and empty suggestions. Now more and more know that he is the same old story, that he offers promises of concessions, but attacks us. And we've been peaceful throughout the demonstration. but he attacks us with thugs and with his party crooning in a very fascist manner. And I believe more people will be going down on Friday to really. I mean, it's called Departure Friday. And if he stayed till then, we believe he will be. We will stand down. He tried everything, and people really didn't accept the empty promises he was giving.
That was FSRN's Lillian Boktor speaking to activist and blogger Wael Khalil. Demonstrations also took place in Yemen today, the second time in less than a week. An estimated 20,000 gathered near a university in the capital, Sana'a, calling for the immediate end to the three-decade-long regime of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. In a smaller rally in Liberation Square, thousands of Saleh supporters also demonstrated. This follows the president's announcement yesterday that neither he or his son would run for re-election in 2013. The rallies were largely peaceful, but there were reports of several injured. Academics and political analysts, mainly from the US, have signed a statement calling on President Obama to uphold democratic values and change US foreign policy in the Middle East. The letter says the president should undertake a, quote, comprehensive review of US foreign policy on the major grievances voiced by the democratic opposition in Egypt and all other societies of the region. Josh Stacker is a Middle East specialist and assistant professor of political science at Kent State University. He's one of the signatories who crafted this letter and says about 600 academics have now signed. And Professor Stacker is with me now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What kind of new policy do you want to see?
We think this is an extremely important moment and opportunity in time. We wanted to make an important statement, and the letter basically has two points to it. One, you know, the Egyptian people have clearly articulated what their demands are. They're rational. They're cognizant of what's going on. They do not want Mubarak. They do not want to be ruled by the military. And we think that the president should respect that demand. And they should amplify the hopes and aspirations of the millions that are demonstrating in Egypt.
President Obama, after some hesitation, says a transition should start now. How do you see this administration's response to the uprising, and is it any different to the response of previous U.S. governments to, say, the fall of the Marcos regime in the Philippines, Duvalier in Haiti, and others?
When we look at the sort of policy of the United States, it's been desperately behind the curve on this. Initially they started saying that, you know, Egypt was a stable regime. Vice President Biden said that he wouldn't refer to Hosni Mubarak as a dictator. Clearly that was when they were in the alternative universe aspect of this crisis. Then it moved on to, well, you have to have immediate reform now. Unfortunately, that was also behind the curve because there were tanks on the street at that point. And you can't immediately reform when there's tanks on the streets. You immediately reform before those come out. And then lastly, we've entered this sort of orderly transition of power. And the United States has appeared very neutral in this. They've appeared not to choose a side. They've appeared not to choose a leader. But by not choosing, they actually have still chosen, right? They've chosen the status quo. So it may not be Mubarak, but it's going to be Vice President Omar Suleiman. It's going to be the Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq. It might be the Chief of Staff of the Army, Sami Adnan. They've designated a successor by their silence.
You talk about this alternative universe. Why was and is this regime so valued by the U.S. government and its allies?
Well, Hosni Mubarak does whatever the United States wants. There's no debate about that. There's very little that he would refuse to do that we ask him. I mean, even if it's enormously unpopular in his own country. That's the crux of the matter. Anwar Sadat signed the peace treaty with Egypt that forever stitched the American and United States together because of all the military aid. I mean, they've received over $55 billion of aid in the last 31 years. And the military aid has been $1.3 billion a year. So this is a place that we've invested a lot of time, money, and sort of capital in. It would be very difficult to then handed over to a public that wants to be democratic, and this would mean that we would have to enter negotiations over our policies, or we might have to compromise on our policies, rather than having Egypt just be the reliable vassal of American foreign policy in the region.
When this uprising was kicking off, there was a delegation of Egyptian generals being hosted by the Pentagon here in the U.S. How close are relations between the U.S. and Egyptian armed forces?
Oh, they're incestuous. To be completely clear, only one country in the world receives more United States aid, and that's Israel. And second off, the beauty behind the Camp David Accord and the military aid aspect of this provided two things. One, it provided a lack of political accountability in that our generals can talk to their generals at any moment in time, right? Without having to sort of justify why they're talking. They can just say, the treaty. Secondly, the aid was also a political act in another way. What the aid effectively did was purchase the loyalty of the armed forces and stitch it to the chief executive's office in Egypt. And if we look at how the protests have gone the past couple days, what we're seeing is exactly that, that the military has held extremely loyal and firm to the offices of President Hosni Mubarak and the other generals.
And yet I can hear officials in U.S. governments, past and present, saying perhaps that the threat of radical Islam is the reason why we need to support the military in Egypt and other places. How much of a threat is radical Islam, or is it an Egyptian democracy that could be more of a threat to U.S. foreign policy?
By far, it's Egyptian democracy that's the threat to American strategic interests in the region. There is the radical elements that exist in Egypt do not have a large social base. The reference that I think maybe you're getting at is the Muslim Brotherhood and what the Muslim Brotherhood reformed itself in the 1960s. It hasn't been implicated in any violence. It participates peacefully in elections. By all accounts, it's a big, large group that's not monolithic. There's various streams in it. I don't think we have to worry about some sort of Iranian-style takeover because it's not even clerically based. To give you an example of this, groups like Al-Qaeda, like Ayman Zawahiri, have criticized the Muslim Brotherhood for not being radical enough. So the Muslim Brotherhood has actually been more of an agent of status quo in Egypt than it has been out in the protests.
Given the unpopularity of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, what can this administration do to overcome that?
That's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure what they can do. My advice to the administration is amplify what you've seen in the streets of Cairo and other Egyptian cities. Recognize the voices of the people that are talking about democracy. So if they want stability in the Middle East, democracies are much more stable than little military-backed authoritarian regimes.
Josh Stacker, Assistant Professor and Middle East Specialist at Kent University. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Okay, thank you very much.
Violence in Thailand's southern provinces shows no sign of ending following an attack today that left a number of Buddhists dead and injured. Although the government claims attacks over the past year decreased, many are concerned about the rising death toll of mostly civilians and government workers. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
In the latest attack Wednesday, five Buddhist villages were killed and several injured when gunmen in a pickup truck opened fire on families, some making their way to the local temple. Children were reported among the injured. This follows a string of other attacks, including nine civilians killed by a roadside bomb while travelling in a utility truck, and an insurgent attack last month on an army base in southern Thailand's Narithawat province. That attack left four soldiers dead, including the base commander, and 13 other soldiers wounded. The latest violence adds to the toll from Thailand's southern insurgency that has claimed the lives of more than 4,300 people since attacks escalated in 2004. Thai police reports seen by FSRN show few signs of an easing in bloodshed, with the region facing ongoing shootings, bombings, assaults on government personnel and civilians, both Muslim and Buddhist. But Thai government spokesman Panattan Wattaniagorn says progress is being made towards reducing violence. The government also eased martial law in some districts.
But of course, the incidents that took place in various districts relating to violence are still of concern on the selected targets, especially on officers, especially on teachers, especially on several government workers.
The Thai military has more than 30,000 troops in the region backed by local militia units. Police put numbers of militants at 2,000, with 5,000 local supporters, 300 strategic leaders, and 300 so-called psychological leaders. Amnesty International researcher Benjamin Zawachi, who recently visited the south, says despite easing some emergency powers, many remain fearful.
Of course, they measure progress based on their daily level of safety. And they, you know, there was definitely frustration that that had not markedly improved, you know, for the past, 7 years now.
The Puttani region bordering with Malaysia was previously a sultanate until incorporated into then Siam in 1909. Since then, insurgents have regularly fought the Thai central government seeking a return to independence. Through the 1990s, a special unit that combined civilian, military and police personnel successfully mediated within the local community. But this combined force was disbanded in 2001 during Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat's time in office. Today, much of the region remains under martial law. Ankana Nilapaichit, a rights advocate, says abuses have undermined government support and increased uncertainties within local communities. She says charges of extrajudicial killings go unanswered.
All the cases that people feel unjust, they cannot access the justice, high justice system.
Ankana's husband, human rights lawyer Somchai Nilapaichit, disappeared in 2004 and is presumed killed by police officers. He had accused the army of using torture against a group of Muslim men he was defending. Ankana says people in the region are caught between the government and insurgency.
When they didn't trust the Thai government, maybe they want the insurgent side, the insurgent to protect them.
The Organization of Islamic Conference, OIC, has offered to play a role in mediating between the insurgents and Thai government, highlighting OIC concerns over local justice. In an editorial, the Bangkok-based English-language newspaper The Nation called on the government to consider the OIC initiative. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
In Washington, D.C., a district judge has heard a challenge to the decades-old Voting Rights Act. The case involves a county in Alabama which has become the latest jurisdiction to pose a challenge to the law that prohibits discrimination at the voting booth. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was a crucial piece of civil rights-era legislation. It prohibited widespread polling taxes, literacy tests, and other punitive forms of voting requirements, primarily targeting African Americans. Shelby County, Alabama, is now trying to overhaul the law. They took their case to U.S. District Court. In oral arguments before Judge John Bates Wednesday, Shelby County Attorney Burt Ryan said Shelby County has spent money and resources to alter their voting system. He told FSRN the 1965 guidelines are outdated.
But we certainly know that the current formula, which tries to capture the world of 1964, 68, and 72, has no real relevance to today's conditions.
Nine states and some districts in seven other states, most of them in the South, have to seek permission from the Justice Department before any election changes are made. Shelby County says the process of obtaining what's known as pre-clearance is onerous. Again, Bert Ryan.
So the question is not whether there are isolated incidences, it's how many and whether those incidences form a pattern of discrimination sufficient to warrant the extraordinary remedy of preclearance.
But proponents of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act say specific instances should be taken as proof that discrimination still exists. According to legal documents filed by the defendants, the Department of Justice found 421 cases of direct and intentional discrimination between 1980 and 2000. John Greenbaum, with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, represented the defendants.
The jurisdictions that are covered under the coverage formula continue to be jurisdictions that discriminate against minority voters, and that's the justification for why Congress acted appropriately in continuing to cover them. It's not about what they were doing in 1964, 1968, or 1972, except to the extent that it's important to show that these places have a history of discrimination as well.
Greenbaum points to a recent case in Shelby County where a town changed its election system from at-large to single-district elections, which led to the election of a black representative. But in 2008, the town removed the black district, which resulted in the loss of the black representative. The courts reversed the redistricting, and the black candidate won his seat back. Greenbaum says voters are entering a crucial time for ensuring voting rights.
A lot of the voting changes tend to take place in connection with when jurisdictions have to redistrict. And so at the beginning of every decade, or towards the beginning of every decade, there's an enormous amount of Section 5 submissions because jurisdictions are drawing new districts, they're changing precincts, they're changing polling places.
Civil rights advocates point out that Congress overwhelmingly passed a 25-year extension of the Voting Rights Act in 2006. The Supreme Court heard a Voting Rights Act case in 2009, but ruled narrowly and kept the law intact. The U.S. District Court decision is expected this spring, and appeals are expected to petition the High Court. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
That's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, Julie Alexander, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.